Okay, we're running a little bit behind schedule, so I'd like to start our next panel. So far today, we've heard in-depth analysis of the prospects for growth in the Japanese economy and the United States economy. And our job on this panel is to talk about how the two economies and the two governments interact, and in particular to focus on an agenda for bilateral economic cooperation, both to spur our two economies directly for economic growth, but also perhaps to work collaboratively in global and regional frameworks to try to promote economic growth through trade, investment, technological innovation, or perhaps other avenues. I have a very distinguished panel to discuss an agenda for economic growth, and we're going to go in order as we are seated. So first will be Grant Aldonis, who is Senior Advisor for CSIS. And because we're short on time, I will not go through all of the speakers' lengthy list of accomplishments and positions, but simply note they have very impressive backgrounds, and I refer you to the biographies that are in your packet. Next, we will have Dr. Ryo Kubota, who is Chairman and President and CEO of Acucela Incorporated. He will be followed by Kevin Kneeler, who is principal and partner in the Scowcroft Group, and finally by Mr. Shunji Yanai, who is a judge of the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea and former Japanese ambassador to the United States. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Aldonis.
Thank you, Amy, and it's great to be here with so many friends, both from Japan and from CSIS. Since my job is usually to challenge assumptions, that's where I'm going to start, certainly where I feel most comfortable. And what I want to do is start by giving a different picture of economic reality, talk a little bit about political realities, and then say what that implies for our bilateral agenda. First of all, the economic reality, which is something that we didn't touch on talking just about the U.S. economy or just about the Japanese economy, is that globalization and the forces driving it are driving an accelerating pace of economic change. And we have a tendency not to understand that the real challenge we face is grappling with the problem of installed capital as the pace of change is forcing us to come to grips with that. That's a challenge both to how we deal with the issues of adjustment in terms of social safety nets, things of that order, but it's also how we realign the incentives in our own economy and in the global economy in a way that allows that process to happen, that allows us to embrace that process as it unfolds, and frankly to capitalize on it, not only for our benefit, but frankly for the benefit of the world. So the bottom line of what I'm going to say and what I'll come back to is that what we need is a partnership that looks outward. What we don't need is a partnership that looks exclusively to a bilateral agenda. Everything that we do should be taken with steps in mind for how we need to reorient the global economy and the incentives. And any precedent we set, whether it's in the context of a free trade agreement, whether it's a services arrangement, as Mr. Hatakayama was talking about, or my preference would be really to create a common and virtual commercial environment that implies a deeper level of economic integration, is something we should do with in mind for the precedent that we're setting for the global economy we'd like to see, and a global economy that would actually vindicate the ability of Japanese citizens and U.S. citizens to succeed on their own as a part of that process. So the economic reality, first of all, what globalization has done or the forces driving it is fundamentally alter the structure of international trade and redraw economic geography. In 2003, we sort of crossed the Rubicon where more than 50% of global trade took place within multinational companies, and a far higher percentage of global trade took place within those companies and the depth of their global supply chains. In the process, we redrew economic geography. When the walls fell down with the Cold War, the onset of the WTO and the liberalizations of the Uruguay Round, the revolution in transportation, telecommunications, and logistics, which lowered the cost of, I have to say as an aside here, in the 1960s and 1970s, the cost of transportation was roughly between 6 and 12% of imports and export values in the United States. Today, it's a footnote in terms of the actual cost of moving goods globally. that tells you an awful lot, because as we were busy negotiating 3% reductions in chemical tariffs for the benefit of FMC, there was a revolution going on that was removing the barriers that was really outside the bounds of what we were discussing in the context of what we conventionally think about as trade policy. Well, in the process, what did that do? It actually redrew the boundaries. It allowed the possibility of a global supply chain, which, of course, as in all things in the global economy, immediately made a global supply chain a competitive necessity. That's the reality within which both large firms now operate and small firms now operate. When I was Undersecretary of Commerce, it's great to go out and talk with entrepreneurs, in part because they always give you insights that you don't get just by looking at the numbers. I was talking with a guy in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He was an auto parts supplier, and as the Undersecretary of Commerce, I wondered why I wasn't hearing from the auto parts suppliers, which had registered so many complaints about Japan and Korea over time. I never heard from him. I asked him why. He said, well, the truth is I don't export to a land called Japan. I export to a place called Toyota Land, right? I mean, what he was saying was, I need to find a way into Toyota's supply chain. They will take me global, and that's what he did. And so he's not suffering now. I checked back in with him. He's not suffering now that there's less growth domestically with General Motors. He's benefiting from the fact that he's aligned his own way of doing business in a way that succeeds with the best player in the global economy, in the auto sector. That's the nature of the change that we're seeing at that microeconomic level. What's equally important is that from the point of view of the global firms, and again, it's U.S. and Japanese companies that dominate, they are less and less individual manufacturers or service providers, and the right way to think about them is systems integrators. What they do is they mobilize the capital, talent, and ideas that end up producing goods and services for a global marketplace. They run a single global supply chain to serve that global marketplace. I recall IBM used to run a supply chain for Japan, supply chain for Europe, a supply chain in the United States. That doesn't exist in IBM any longer. They ask even their health insurers to step up and play on a global basis and meet their needs across the global scope of the company. Well, in that context, what you're really suggesting is we've got a global economy in which you have these global players that can touch global supplies of talent and ideas. In the midst of that, what it creates is enormous opportunities for specialization that didn't previously exist. And the factors that contribute most to specialization, talent, ideas, are the things that are most rewarded in a knowledge-driven global economy. That's the world that we're living in. So, what's the political reality? Well, in Washington, of course, the political reality is about 40 years behind the economy. We are fused. We're hardwired now into the global economy. We are beyond the scope where we could say we were isolated from it. We are now very much a part of it. And certainly the global companies that drive a lot of the technological change in our economy are a part of the global economy. With that in mind, we have to kind of look at the mindset of the town of Washington that is setting up, and I would say this is an instinct, a more populist shift in our politics that affects both parties. For Democrats, of course, it's a debate about trade, mostly driven by the unions and their opposition to free trade agreement. For Republicans, it's a debate about immigration. But what you have to appreciate is the motivation is the same. It's the notion that we can build a wall around our prosperity rather than understanding our prosperity is ultimately linked to our engagement in the global economy. But that, to me, is the political paradigm that has narrowed the political space within which we can collaborate with Japan and within which we can collaborate with the rest of the world on trade, on the global economic engagement, at least beyond the crisis of dealing with the financial situation. The situation in Japan, I think, is somewhat similar in its broad architecture, but for a very different reason. Obviously, a seismic political shock in Japan, and necessarily a focusing inward as Japan tries to grapple with the uncertainty that this new political dynamic creates. But what we've done, in one sense, is turned our backs on each other as a part of the process. And what I would suggest is not only because our future lies in the global economy, because we're much better off doing it together, it's time that we turn around, faced each other, agreed on what our course of action should be, and then faced back outward to deal with the global economy. Now, there's some other political realities that factor into that, most of which are global. The truth is we're living in a system of Westphalian nation states, and yet we have a global economy. There is a demand for global economic governance which the nation state system can't grasp, can't supply. It requires cooperation. And the point of our partnership should be to lead that level of cooperation. Now, what does that imply? I think certainly on monetary and fiscal side, there's a lot we could do to better coordinate how we approach the idea of a return to global economic growth. I agree with everything Mike said about the U.S. economy and the potential for a relatively robust recovery in the short term. I don't feel hopeful about the long term because we've done absolutely nothing to realign the incentives in the economy that brought us to the bubble that blew up on us. If you think about it, I mean, I hate to say this, but we're a year or so into this, and the great debate in Washington is about executive pay. I have yet to find an economist that told me executive pay created the bubble that collapsed and led to the decline of Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers. No, the reality of it was a set of policies that favored real estate investment over other productive investment, and a series of regulatory failures on the part of our SEC, the Treasury, and the Fed, and a lax monetary policy where there were too many dollars chasing too few good investments. That's the nuts and bolts of it. But we haven't done anything yet that would actually address those fundamentals in terms of the economy. So longer term, one of the things that I think we both need to do is think about how we realign the incentives in our own domestic economy so that it supports a long-term stable growth strategy, both in Japan and the United States, where we still dominate the world economy and, as a consequence, need to be mindful of the spillover effects into the rest of the economy. Well, what does that suggest in terms of specifics? In terms of specifics, the debate is always, and I've always been a huge proponent of a free trade agreement between the United States and Japan. I was thinking about it from a political angle, saying to myself, I know it's getting harder and harder to do what we were doing in terms of free trade agreements. Someone who looked very much like me once told Ambassador Zelek that I was expecting that our next FTA would be with the outer asteroid belt because there was so little sort of commercial value and there was such a big and painful political cost to trying to move every one of those free trade agreements through the Congress. We are now stuck on trade policy in part because that's the course that we pursued. What we need to be pursuing are things that matter commercially. So there's a reason for both Democrats and Republicans to engage constructively on behalf of their constituencies and grapple with the collective action problems that these sorts of negotiations always create. But what I would suggest as a way of trying to expand the political space that both Prime Minister Hatoyama and President Obama now lack in terms of this sort of engagement is to create something very different as a model of economic integration. What I would suggest we have to shoot for is what I have described as a common commercial enterprise. What it has to recognize is that in this global economy, many of the things we've conventionally talked about in terms of trade agreements, border measures, anti-dumping, countervailing duties, things like that, are irrelevant. What really matters are things like the UN Convention on the International Sale of Goods, which reduces uncertainty and risk in international transactions. My point in saying that is that many of the things that we have that we should think about as tools of integration don't fit within the conventional boundaries of the way we talk about trade between the United States and Japan. And until we recognize that, both in the bureaucracies at USTR and Commerce and at METI, and in both finance ministries, we won't kind of escape the logic of sitting down and once again recooking the same ideas in the same template of a free trade agreement. Now, what do I mean by that? What I really mean is that we have to be looking at a common problem, which is first to create between ourselves a freely contestable market, and then that has to be something that we are trying to translate into the global economy. And if I look at the issue of China through that lens, I have to say I'm not one who fears China the way a lot of people in Congress seem to. If, I don't know if you guys have ever had that experience when you show up in Shanghai and you're with a congressman or a senator and they see Pudong. And the first time they see Pudong, the blood drains from their face, and they think, that's it. It's all over for us, right? And, you know, you have to remind them, well, if you go 100 miles west of Xi'an, you have 650 million people with no implement other than a handheld hoe. You have to remind them that the buildings in Pudong are about between 10% and 50% full in terms of occupancy. You have to go through the logic of the delicacy in some respects of what China is doing and find a way to draw them constructively into this exercise. But what I would suggest is the stronger that we can make the level of economic integration between the United States and Japan, the more inviting it is for China to adopt our model. Now, why do I think that's important? I think it's important because we're seeing the rise of global emerging giants in both China and India that have developed under very different sets of rules and very different sets of circumstances. They are not transparent. The choices they make will lead to greater instability and the greater possibility of discontinuities in the global economy, unless what we're trying to create is in an open, transparent environment in the global economy in which they operate. That means that's something we have to start between the United States and Japan first. So let me stop there. Thanks.
Good morning, everyone. First of all, I would like to thank two organizations, ICIS and JEF, that invited me. And above all, I would like to thank to everyone in this room for coming this morning, and also to Mr. Hatakeyama, because I came to the United States about 10 years ago, and I was very pessimistic after being in the United States about Japan's like future. But I really thank Mr. Hatakeyama to think outside the box, inviting someone like me to this very established meeting. That was very eye-opener for me, that I see the positive change and willing to maybe consider some other options that may come to some kind of a solution that to the problem that we're facing. A little bit of my background. I'm an ophthalmologist by training. I originally came to the United States about in early 1970s for about 3 years due to my father's job transition. And I had the privilege to learn the diversity, the value of diversity in the United States. It was very eye-opener then to me as well, because it was so shocking from coming from very homogeneous culture that you don't even have to talk to other people to have them understood what you're thinking. And that's considered a very good virtue in Japan, that less talking and just more like telepathy and people understand what you're thinking. And more talking is not good. So I had to overcome that to be more talkative. I was very quiet, very introverted, but I have to train myself to be very extroverted, and you have to express yourself. And even if you go to the meeting and you sit with 10 different people, you'll be surprised the outcome that everybody took out of the meeting is so different. And you have to constantly remind yourself that people can have a diversity. And in the United States, they have every single people in the room may have a very different take-home message from the same meeting. So you have to really confirm. That really helped me to understand how to run the organization in multicultural background right now, what I'm doing. So that really helped me to come to the conclusion that diversity is really powerful. And homogeneity can be powerful in certain settings, but diversity can be powerful in other settings. So I would like to bring this bilateral collaboration that we're doing between – I'm not any straight form of any economist or anything. I'm just a very small entrepreneur, and I'm more micro than nano type of a scale of economy that I'm contributing. But nevertheless, I have some maybe insight that may contribute to this group of people in this room. So this bilateral collaboration, like we heard from Mr. Alnanas, that this bilateral collaboration has to lead to global impact. And what we're doing as a pharmaceutical collaboration is two bilateral Japanese pharma and U.S. biotech collaboration, but that can lead to have a global impact, because we're in the business where there is no border, especially in the pharmaceutical business. Patients are all over the place. So once you have a fantastic drug, it's not only for Japan, it's not only for the U.S., it's for global, it's for everyone. So I think, although it's a bilateral collaboration, we're thinking global. So I think in that sense, I really resonate with what Mr. Adana said. We have to think global. And we have a lot of good example between Japan and U.S. collaboration in pharmaceutical industry historically. One of the greatest example is Amgen. There's a book, Science Lessons, written by Gordon Binder, former CEO of Amgen, that he said that one of the most important factor of Amgen's success. By the way, Amgen worth more than $56 billion, almost $60 billion today as a market cap, which doubles Takeda, and even bigger than extremely established corporation like Mitsubishi Corporation in terms of market cap. So how were they able to create that type of big enterprise that had huge global impact? is because they had a collaboration with Kirin. He's stating in his book that the best collaboration he had was with Japanese pharma that was mutually respectful with very long-term consistent view. And he said that the worst collaboration that he had in his book, it says in his book, so it's not my personal opinion, but the worst collaboration he had was Johnson & Johnson. Johnson & Johnson is a very reputable company, has a very high profile and respect in Japan especially and in the United States. But he said that all the executives had to be Johnson & Johnson free because they're so upset about the collaboration they had with Johnson & Johnson, constantly litigating each other. So they really think that the collaboration with Japan, Japanese pharma, really created their company. And I think that's true because after year 2000, we have seen over 130 collaborations established between Japanese pharma and U.S. biotech, even with that short period of time. And we're seeing more and more. I think that's the model that we're going after as well. And what is good about Japanese pharma is they think things in long term. And that's very different from some of the U.S. partners that is worried about Wall Street and thinking about every quarter reporting. Because pharmaceuticals drug development will take at least 10 years, if not 15 years, in terms of drug development's life cycle. So you have to think long term. If you think about very short term, of course you have to cut the R&D and just, you know, increase the profit. But that's not going to do any good in long term to bring good medicine to the world. And in that sense, Japanese pharma can think in long term, and working with U.S. biotech that is very agile and very adaptive. One thing I learned from this diversity that I was exposed in my younger in my career led to my interest in genetics. I have a PhD in molecular genetics, and I learned from that genetics that the diversity is important in even the strength of organisms or ourselves. The gene pool that is diverse is helping us, and this diversity or even this just small mistakes that we have in gene duplication causing mutation is leading to our evolution and creating better people. So that type of environment in the U.S. will create different people in the room to come up with different ideas. Sometimes could be very, very outside the box, but that can bring to the solution. So we need to be prepared with very different type of thinking to make sure that we can address all the external environment that's constantly changing and changing in ever rapid speed, more rapid speed than ever. And we have to make sure that so that Japanese pharma is very good in long-term consistency, just like Mr. Goto explained in his presentation, Japanese culture is with this consistency that really helped us where we are. But sometimes they have a very good consistent and maintaining long-term vision, but they may be a little rigid in maintaining all the strategy as well. We have to have a long-term goal for our situation to preventing blindness. But we have to be very flexible about how we get there in terms of strategy. So marriage between Japanese pharma with long-term goal of thinking long-term vision with the agility and adaptability of U.S. biotech that can figure out the best strategy with constant changing way of thinking to get to the goal that Japanese pharma wants to get to. And of course, like Dr. Hamry told us, that we have to have a common goal and a joint goal that can lead to bigger result than otherwise achieved by each people. So we have to make sure that both companies have the same goal, but understanding that working together may lead to bigger impact. So that's just I don't want to go over this. It's in your kind of packet. So just to summarize what I would like to say today is that for successful partnership, first I'd like to talk about just general partnership. We have to have common goals and common values. When I mean by values, it really comes to the very bottom of a collaboration. We met with several think tank people yesterday, and we know that maintaining even like Japan-U.S. alliance or this national security alliance is very, very challenging. Even just shifting one base to the other place took 13 years to discuss. So we have to really understand what we are trying to achieve together really, really well. Do we really want to achieve that each organization has to have that understanding. What do we want to achieve? And what the common goal is. Because unless you have that common goal, and constantly leadership is telling each member of the team that your common goal is, it's not going to be sustainable. Because day-to-day negotiation, day-to-day dealing, if you do it by yourself, it's much easier. If you do it bilateral or multilateral, it's more complex and it's tedious. It's painful. You have to understand that the leadership has to understand that there is a lot of tedious and painful steps that you have to go through. But in the end, we have a very fruitful goal. So we have to share that philosophy, not just a superficial pretending to share, but you have to really share the goal to the bottom of the heart in order to have that successful collaboration. And cultural awareness, you have to have a very different you have to understand that the language or communication style or values and those things can be very different. Even if you think about one thing, it can be all different. Let's go from point A to point B. If you talk to Japanese people, they will start to figure out what's the historical knowledge about this and do all the planning and take everyone to really figure out and come up with one solution that's unanimous and then go through. But if you talk to French people, if I have 50 people, they come up with a very different solution. They just run and do. I learned this from I sat on my flight to Paris. I sat with one gentleman that had played a key role in Renault-Nissan integration. And he told me how painful it was to bring two alliances together. But in that his experience, he had to spend 2 years of going to public bath with all the people in the employee and in his dorm that he lived to understand who they are, where they're coming from. And he came to understanding that Japanese people think that way and French people in a different way. But that level of understanding and maintenance of a collaboration and cultural awareness is so important because you'll be surprised how different people think. And we have to have a very good strategic fit. And in our situation, Otsuka Pharmaceutical has a very strong presence in global marketing ability, and we have a strong presence in science. So we can work together with what they need. You have to have something. You have to bring something to the table. Unless you create your own value that can provide benefit to others, what's the point of doing collaboration? So you have to really maintain your own value. It's so important to have equal footing. It's also same for, I think, Japan-American situation. I think Japan has to be credible and provide big value before you can say, let's do an equal footage. Maybe we're already equal footage, but you have to constantly provide the value. Otherwise, it will be obsolete. And you have to have a good expertise and excellence to do the partnership. And with Japanese pharmaceutical partner, we know that they're long-term and it's relationship-based, and fairness and respect. This is so important to maintain long-term relationship. Life is so short to work, so you want to work with somebody you like and somebody you feel comfortable, somebody you can respect, someone you can feel the same value. So it's important, and Japanese companies tend to really value this fairness and respect. So I think in that sense, it's a very valuable partner for us. And we need to have this with partners. So in conclusion, established collaboration is just the first step, but maintaining is very, very important. And we have to be mindful that the maintenance alliance is not easy. And leadership has to understand that we have to really take care of the people dealing with day-to-day maintenance of a collaboration, because it's not easy job. It's a huge undertaking. Unless you have that awareness, I don't think you can maintain good collaboration. And I will end my talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kubota. And next we have Kevin Neeler.
Well, thank you indeed. It's a pleasure to be here. Mindful of both the hour and the fact that I'm in on the joke. I understand. I'm the speed bump on the way to Yanai-san and Goodman. And I'll try. Also, in light of the fact of the declining U.S. equity values, I will reduce the duration of my comments by 30%, which is to say I'll tell you everything I know. The work that I've been asked to do is to look at the investment issue. As Ambassador Aldonis was talking about, trade flows, I'm reminded of the fact that this is, third week in January. In another 2 weeks, the amount of money that moves around the world annually will exceed for this year, for 2010, the amount of goods and services that by December will have occurred. So if you want to follow what matters and a real vote of confidence in relationships, follow the movement of money. My 16-year-old daughter tells me that there's a song called what was the name of it? I had to write it down. You can't remember these things. The End of the World as We Know It. And in the last couple of meetings with Japanese friends, that seems to have been the music playing in the background about the relationship. I must tell you, coming from the investment community, what Dr. Hamry said and the other words of warning, and I take them for what they are about Futenma and managing the exquisitely complicated relationship that's so multifaceted at a time of enormous political change in Japan. Let's allow it's a huge challenge, but on the investment side, I look at the sustaining day-to-day reality. I look at the way my business community friends behave. I think they would not recognize the relationship in crisis that becomes the common parlance in the policy community. They don't see it at all. Had the screen been blank, I would have told you that while I had eschewed a PowerPoint, I had brought my list of current and outstanding neuralgic issues in U.S.-Japan investment. Pointing to nothing. There's almost nothing for those of us who came out of the experience of the 80s that rise to the dignity of serious bilateral head knocking. Matt Goodman will correct the record on that score. But I am burdened by the history. I remember the last time we were engaged in shared financial crisis management, I saw the limits of our skills. Any of us who were in Hong Kong for the bank fund meetings in 1997 watched American and Japanese officials walk past each other, literally because they had nothing to say, because we had totally different views of how to crisis management in 1997. Some of those of you were involved in the diplomatic sphere at the time and found the pain of that evident. But what's happened in the meantime, as we've gotten through this economic crisis, the background music on U.S.-Japan cooperation on investment has been that habits of cooperation, both private and public sector, have proved, as far as I'm concerned, deep and durable. It was almost unnoticed. It was literally a footnote in some of the stories that in the incipient stages of the crisis, as it became clear how serious the challenge that we were facing was 18 months plus ago, there's a little notice that the Fed and the Bank of Japan had reached across at their initiative to the Bank of England and the ECB and the Swiss ultimately joined. To do what? To create a currency swap arrangement. These are the kind of things that I think for the business community, very properly, folks just note and move on. For the financial community and for the deep architecture of the investment community, that's the kind of stuff that goes unnoticed because it works. Had it not happened, we would be having a very different meeting today. The fact that you put that kind, that you shored up the systems, that almost instinctively the central bankers were on the phone working out what they would do in the event of deeper liquidity crisis to American companies. And they came up with a plan, I mean, literally within days. That laid a predicate for everything else that's been done since. And I would say don't take that for granted. When we have these meetings, it always forces me to go back to government reports and something as banal as the U.S.-Japan Investment Initiative. I see Jay McNaughton sitting out there. He and others who were involved, as you and I some was, with the artifacts of the strategic, the SII talks. This is one of them. But this report comes out, and it noted this year that, let me read from it, despite the severe global recession beginning in the last quarter of 2008, FDI stocks in Japan at the end of 2008 had risen 3.4 trillion yen from the previous year, making it the largest single increase on record. And I'm mindful of what Kojima-san said about the overall valuation of the overall place Japan has in attracting foreign investment. But just imagine, this is 18.5 trillion yen, or about $179.6 billion. So the share of the FDI's share of GDP in Japan shot up from 2.9 to 3.6%. The U.S. share of that FDI was up some 35% compared to the end of 07. And these are huge jumps. Remember what's happening. The world is ending in the background, and investment flows are doing what? And importantly, as Grant pointed out, trade is contracting. And the reason Grant and I got involved in trade policy is because when we were undergraduates, we saw these charts that since the 30s, trade growth looked like this. It never went down. Good times, bad times. Trade just grew incrementally. For a person of mediocre and a person of much better talent, we realized this was an opportunity for us. Well, trade went down. But what happened to investment? It went up. It went up. I was going to have Mike Musa talk more about that, but I thought, no, I only have one or two things to say, so I'll keep that point for myself. The background music in the U.S. at the same time was very similar. U.S. FDI stock was about $2.1 trillion at the end of 07, up 13.5% from 06. And then in 08, right, the world should end. Well, in 08, foreigners invested $260 billion in U.S. companies. It's equities. Forget the government debt stuff. This is buying into U.S. companies. Those are heroic levels and expressions of confidence. Obviously, a disproportional investor was Japan at that time. I note that just in the year to date, I was looking at the fact that overseas investment into Japan, into Japanese equities, in the first 2 weeks up to January 15, it was up $13 billion. That's a lot of money. It's especially a lot of money in a bad time where everyone's celebrating the continued failure of the Japanese economy. I would ask you, what do Byron Wine, David Harrow, and John Alkier know that we don't know? Why are we seeing those kind of capital flows from the United States into Japan? I think they're not just they're not acts of policy generosity. These are people who believe in the growth and sustainability of the Japanese economy. To jump back up to 30,000 feet for just a moment, as we're approaching a year in which Japan is hosting APEC and then the U.S. follows, I note that the notional title of Japan's sponsorship is sustainable and inclusive growth. Matt can say a lot more about this. That for those of us who have worked in government, these notional rubrics, the big ideas that are supposed to guide these meetings often turn into fluff in your hands. But let me suggest, I think our Japanese colleagues have given a lot of thought to this issue, looking at where cooperation with the U.S. in particular is possible. What if we were to carry into the year of U.S. sponsorship of APEC that same themes? Look at the things that we both do well, whether it's clean technology, energy conservation, or renewables. Across a range of options, across a range of actions, rather, in talking to investment community clients that we have, Japan keeps coming up as a model for the right way to achieve sustainable growth. As people get reflective about, as they look around at the ashes of the last 2 years, and start to think about how do you build on the foundation in a way that is going to last a while. For all the talk about Japan's negative lessons, I hear an awful lot of conversation about the positive lessons. Whether it's, we talked about this a little with our earlier speakers, corporate compensation that Grant mentioned, and wage differentials. I can tell you that China is not a model for the successful management of those issues and for growth and sustainability on that score. Social safety net, health, infrastructure development. Look at what we're doing jointly in the Mekong Delta. People are not talking about the China model of investment development in the rest of Southeast Asia. I sit on the board of a the largest private equity fund in Indonesia. They're not imitating or looking to imitate Chinese models. They see them as very constrained, very insular, and the product of a unique set of circumstances. Rather, they're looking at Japanese companies for reinforcement and for positive ideas. So too, financial sector regulation. Takayama-san mentioned the idea of the bank tax. Well, forget whether or not the bank tax is the better or the worst ideas in the world. We have a shared view, or a nearly shared view, as I understand it, of corporate governance. It's very different, by the way, from where the Europeans are. So on the APEC agenda and otherwise in the bilateral conversation, I can well imagine U.S. and Japanese views converging more and more over time. Again, I'm keenly aware of the time constraint, which at present is 2 minutes. So I'll close with one thought. There are those of us, you know, in the Washington community, there's the Japan hands and there are the China hands. And then there are people like myself who have demonstrated no capacity in either country and are declared Japan and China hands.
No hands.
I will say this about the U.S.-Japan relationship, the U.S.-China relationship in contrast with, as troubled as you may think it is, the U.S. relationship with Japan at the moment. What we, I think, are discovering, and I'm not speaking for the administration, but I'm watching both the commercial realities and what seems to be unfolding on the policy front. Despite the discussion of G2-type conversations that weighed down on us a year and more ago, the reality is there are very real limits, both as China as a virtuous exemplar, as I said a moment ago, and about what China is prepared to do bilaterally, multilaterally, and in the global scene. We've seen this at Copenhagen. We've seen it in the financial crisis. Yes, they were able to provide liquidity. Yes, as Michael said, they were a positive contributor to growth. But I notice the kind of cooperation, the stopgap cooperation, a thing like currency swaps, the Bank of China, or I'm sorry, the PBOC was not a participant in those big ideas. They are unaccustomed to, they, the Chinese, are unaccustomed to a vigorous role outside their own borders. If you want to stop a conversation, a dinner conversation with Chinese colleagues, ask them about their OECD membership. You'll end it fairly crisply. And ironically, one of the other constraints about China's role in the region and its role in supporting Japanese and American shared goals of sustainable development as we crawl out of the crisis is, if you're sitting down, and you are, a lack of human resources. There is this mythic view that 1.4 billion Chinese necessarily produces this highly mobile and capable force of intellectuals who can go out and give strength to China's world presence. I would say yes, but I worked for the JAWE, the Ministry of State Education, when I was a Fulbright professor. The JAWE announced last year that how many engineers come out of China? Well, a third of them were not only unemployed, but they were unemployable. The system simply hadn't produced the world-class capacity that China needs, even to sustain its internal growth, let alone to show up on the world stage and to play this wanted role. So I think we are in Washington about kind of right-sizing our expectations of the U.S.-China relationship. I hope you and we continue to work together to turn it to best effect, but I think we need to be realistic about it and, frankly, mind our knitting as we go into APEC and think about the things that we can do best together and which are, in fact, an irreplaceable relationship, both globally and in terms of mutually reinforcing features. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kevin. And finally, we have Mr. Ambassador Yanai.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. I have spoken at CSIS on different occasions, and I became a kind of frequent flyer from Tokyo to CSIS. I don't know if CSIS gives me some kind of mileage bonus. Well, this time, while I was leaving home in Tokyo, my wife asked me, to whom am I going to speak? So I said to her, I'm going to speak to my friends from CSIS. And she complained, you speak to them more than you speak to me. So I said to her, well, they listen. Well, we heard excellent presentations by the previous speakers on the substantive part of the agenda of U.S.-Japan cooperation. I was asked to talk about institutional architecture of cooperation. And when I was in the Foreign Service, I was involved in Japan-U.S. relations for most of the time. And in earlier days, the agenda items were almost totally bilateral issues, including the security issues and also trade issues, and especially until the first term of President Clinton. We had a lot of trade issues. But nowadays, towards the end of my career in the Foreign Service, we began to have more and more multilateral issues. And we talked about U.S.-Japan cooperation in global issues. So that's why I would like to discuss the global framework of cooperation. Mr. Neeler referred to APEC, so perhaps I would mention other aspects of international framework. As you know, in 1975, then President Giscard d'Estaing of France invited the heads of states and governments of five other major industrialized nations, including Japan, to Rambouillet, France, to discuss measures to cope with the aftermath of the 1973 oil shock. The following year, in 1976, the G7 summit started when Canada was also invited to attend the meeting in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Russia joined the group as a full member, starting with the Birmingham summit in 1998, and the forum became the G8. The G7, G8 industrialized countries that had a dominant share in the global output managed the world economy for many years. This summit process that started as an institution to discuss and cooperate, coordinate economic policies among the member states gradually grew to cover political and other issues. With the rise of emerging economies, it has become difficult to manage the global economy without their involvement. Particularly, China has begun to play an increasingly important role in the world economy, with her holding the highest amount of foreign currency reserve, possessing the largest trade volume, and the third biggest GDP in the world. In the near future, China is expected to surpass Japan and claim the number two slot. The current financial and economic crisis clearly shows that it is no longer possible to overcome this crisis and to achieve the sustainable growth of the global economy without the participation of the emerging economies such as China, India, and Brazil. In order to engage the emerging economies, a forum consisting of the G8 nations plus five countries was instituted as an outreach of the G8 summit. These five countries include China, India, Brazil, Mexico, and South Africa. But at the Heiligendamm summit of 2007 in Germany, it was agreed to formalize this format as a forum for dialogue between the G8 countries and the five emerging economic powers for a period of 2 years. This process, known as the Heiligendamm process, was extended for another 2 years at the L'Aquila summit of 2009 in Italy as the Heiligendamm-L'Aquila process. However, the emerging economic powers are not satisfied with this framework for the obvious reason that they do not participate in the process on an equal footing with the G8 countries. Because the extended meeting is held in the margin of the G8 summits. On the other hand, there is another institution known as the G20, which consists of the finance ministers and governors of the central banks of 20 countries, which include the G8 countries and 11 other countries, including China, Brazil, etc., and also the presidency of the European Union. The G20 was created in 1999 as a forum in which the emerging economic powers can participate on an equal footing with the G8 countries to discuss financial matters in the event of financial and economic crises. This forum was upgraded to the level of heads of states and governments, and the first G20 summit was held in November 2008 in Washington, D.C. At the September 2009 meeting in Pittsburgh, it was agreed to hold the G20 summit annually. And President Obama described this summit as the prime forum for the management of the world economy. The question arises now whether or not the G20 summit replaces the G8. It is obvious that in light of the increasing importance of the emerging economies, their involvement and commitment are necessary for coping with global economic crises and for assuring sustainable and balanced growth. Nevertheless, the G20 does not seem to be able to replace the G8 summit completely, since there are certain issues that cannot be usefully discussed in the G20 process due to the wide differences of views between the G8 countries on the one hand and some of the G20 countries. For instance, these differences include climate change and development assistance, which may give rise to confrontation between the two types of G20 members. In addition to these issues, there are also political questions on which exchange of views and policy coordination can be made more appropriately among the members of the G8 who share basic social and political values. They are also the major donors of development assistance. These issues include, for instance, human rights issues, the terrorism or the question of a lack of transparency in China or some other emerging countries. So, in spite of the emergence of the G20 process, I think the G8 process still seems to have its own raison d'etre. So this is what I wanted to say. And before concluding, I would like to give you some data about the G20 countries. As you know, the population of the total population of the G8 countries is about 884 million, and its total output GDP amounts to about 34 trillion U.S. dollars, which is still very big. And in the case of G20, the population, the total population, is 3,365,000,000, and the total output GDP is slightly more than 12 trillion U.S. dollars. So. As of now, their total output is smaller, about 30% of the total output of the G8 countries, but their economies are very rapidly growing, so they would catch up very soon. Thank you very much.
And my apologies to the panel that I've been so strict on time, and I hope my harassment has been even-handed to all of you, but I wanted to save room for questions from the floor, the audience, which I invite now, and my only request is that you please try to keep your questions brief so that we can fit in two or three before lunch. Any questions? Yes, Hatakeyama-san?
Although this is a minor issue, APEC was referred to, but APEC was turned out to be too big organization to iron out FTA within it, although APEC is very important. APEC FTA idea is very important in the context of Japan-U.S. cooperation. And in Yokohama, Japan will be hosting this year's APEC meeting, and next year is the U.S. term to host it. And in this regard, FTAP should be sought out. FTAP is identified as a long-term goal as of now. But instead of a long-term goal, why don't we identify it as at least mid-term goal? Suggesting to conclude this by 2020, for example. And as a building block of this FTAP, TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, would be quite interesting. And if an informal request comes from the U.S. or so, to Japan to participate in this TPP, that would be, I think, quite encouraging to new administration of Japan. Do you have something to say?
Don't hold your breath. To describe... Well, let me put it this way. U.S. trade policy is a null set. There is no trade policy. And the longer the debate on health care goes on, the more the possibility of a trade policy recedes into the distance. President Obama narrowed the political space within which he had to operate on trade in the primaries in Ohio when he walked around with Sherrod Brown and tried to borrow Sherrod Brown's brand name. to persuade Democratic voters in Ohio to favor him over Hillary Clinton. In the process, what he did was make commitments that make it very difficult for him to pursue any form of trade liberalizing agenda. In the meantime, this year, unfortunately, Hatakami-san, he has not been able to deliver on a number of things for the unions. The unions continue to exercise a unit veto over any shift toward trade liberalization, at least as you and I would conventionally think of trade liberalization. And this debate now about health care means, and the Massachusetts election, means that Obama needs the unions more than ever to drive his domestic agenda. So their unit veto over trade has gotten stronger. That's one of the reasons why I think tactically to talk about a trade agreement in the conventional sense doesn't make it won't add up to a lot as a political strategy. It does suggest to me that there's a reason to be thinking more broadly about economic integration, in part because it does not move directly to confront the issue of the unions resisting the change I was describing, the changes that globalization have brought, and have a tendency to label a country, whether it's Japan earlier or China now, as the problem, as opposed to understanding that, you know, for a worker in America, and I have to say this, I have to correct John Hamry. As much as I love John, he just doesn't get this. You know, he said that, you know, American workers and Japanese workers have to contend with a billion Chinese workers. It's irrelevant. What matters is if your job can be reduced to an algorithm, a computer will do it. That's what the driving force behind what's going on in our labor. And the labor unions are resisting that. So in one sense, we have to look at issues that allow us to collaborate, that mean something to both the United States and Japan, particularly to our companies, and how we vindicate their interests in the global economy and what they can deliver. And that's why I start thinking along the lines of finding other areas rather than thinking that you'll solve the rice problem and we'll solve the dairy problem and we'll have a free trade agreement. That implies looking outside the trade area in ways that, you know, obviously Kevin's comments about investment foreshadow that. Having a common set of standards about corporate governance, common rules about transparency, common standards about prudential standards in the financial sector. All those things, I think, are fair game for creating what I was describing as a common commercial environment. Sorry for the long-winded answer.
Thanks. Okay, another question? Yes, Tom?
Thank you, Tom. Tom Oak, Bank of Tokyo, Mitsubishi UFJ. My question to Kevin, you talked about FDI between the U.S. and Japan is, say, steady. And I wonder if you could a little bit elaborate the characteristics of FDI. My take is, say, in the 1980s, there's a kind of an ineffective investment, say, Japan purchased a Rockefeller Center, or those are some ineffective investment, but perhaps more productive ones recently. So if you could just elaborate. Thanks.
Tom, you know more about this than I do because you're putting these deals together. But what I would observe is that certainly Japan is no longer paying three times the price of Pebble Beach and Rockefeller Center. We regret that deeply. It's important that there be a class of asset holders willing to pay the three times the price of anything. Japanese investment now, as is the case, I think, for most of the U.S. investment, looks to be doing smart purchases of, and it's everything, isn't it? I mean, the mix now. Last year there was $75 billion worth of, it might be the golden age of M&A work for Japan. $75 billion worth of outbound M&A investment from Japan, a large part of it participating in growth in this country, and it's everything from minority interests in steel mills. To the biotech area and elsewise. All to say, I can't characterize it. The anecdotal evidence I have is it is a rich and very skeptical mix that goes in and does what I think the best of both private equity and other investments do now, which is tear apart the deal. It is unromantic, to the best I can tell, about the politics. I sometimes wonder about what the conversation is now with MUF and METI, with companies like Lone Star that have a significant Japanese presence, you know, as they're invested. I don't think they could care less about what the Japanese government thinks. religiously the character of their investment should be. I may be very wrong about that, but it seems opportunistic, self-interested, and exactly what we would want it to be. But it's my impression is it's a smorgasbord.
Amy, if I could just add to that, Tom, really it's a comment more on what you were saying, Kevin, about what's driving the investment flows, which this is an ugly thing to say, but what American companies did and what I think Japanese companies done is they've actually adjusted well to this recession. They understood what was coming early on. They quickly slashed inventories. They quickly cut as much as they could in terms of jobs, all the rest of the kind of stuff. So what you're looking at are balance sheets that are very strong going into what Mike, of course, was describing as it doesn't have to be a great recovery to still boost an awful lot of value. So from the point of view of the foreign investor looking at the United States right now, there's an awful lot of buying opportunities, and I think that in part is what's driving the investment. Ironically, I'd say the same thing about Japan. You know, the growth prospects aren't as high as we've discussed and we were hearing earlier, but the reality is that we have the illusion that those macro statistics actually mean anything about an individual company's progress. And the truth is there's lots of buying opportunities in Japan as well because of what those companies do that serves global markets, not necessarily talking about the prospects of the Japanese economy as a whole, going to Richard's point about the fact that there's some world-beating companies and then there's an awful lot of people in the domestic economy that aren't all that productive or efficient. But there's right now, you know, the values of companies are actually low relative to what their earning potential is.
Okay, is there one more question from the audience? Yes.
Thank you very much. My name is Washio, and I'm still struggling to figure out what sort of image about the American manufacturing sector within this economy. Actually, I asked this question at the reception corner to the Professor Musa, but I'm still struggling. So I would like to hear your image about the American manufacturing sector in the future, because on the way to this capital city, we visited Chicago, for example, and there are so many American auto parts manufacturers are struggling to survive, honestly speaking. And in that context, would you describe a little bit about the what sort of image do you have in mind regarding to the American manufacturing sector within this economy, and what sort of function this manufacturing sector would contribute to the future growth of this economy as a whole?
Two things. One is, if Lou Dobbs were here, he would tell you that every manufacturer in America is closing their doors tomorrow and that we won't manufacture anything. And what I would tell you is he couldn't be more wrong. It's true that because of the productivity gains, manufacturing employment continues to fall. And it's true that the competitive forces of globalization, because of trade liberalization on industrial goods, drives competition in that sector, both for Japanese companies and for U.S. companies, much more fiercely than it is on services or agriculture or anything of that sort. But they are enormously productive. So for every Chicago auto parts manufacturer, you will find a company in the vicinity of O'Hare, because we're now talking about serving global markets and all that logistical stuff is far more important, but that are manufacturing submersible pumps. I mean hardcore industrial stuff, and they are marketing them in China. And they're doing it because they've got a new technology and they've adapted Japanese manufacturing techniques to the shop floor. So in effect, you have this collaboration of what has been developed in Japanese companies that American companies have learned. They've applied the technologies that they're bringing to the battle, and in effect, they're beating the Chinese. And this, I mean, you can't get any more sort of basic metal bending than producing a pump, right? So at the end of the day, you look at that, and I'm actually pretty heartened about the prospects for manufacturing in America. We do an enormous amount of damage to our manufacturing sector by continuing to inhibit its ability to chase the growth outside our borders. We don't have a trade policy. We have an administration that supports taxing the overseas income. We have a Congress that's interested in getting rid of the foreign tax credit for major U.S. companies. When you add all that up, it is a burden for companies when all the growth is going to be in Asia. I'm not saying we won't have strong growth in the United States, but globally, the high growth is in Asia. our companies, our manufacturing companies, need to get there in many respects. Our fiscal policies and our trade policy, or the lack thereof, is penalizing their ability to chase that growth. Why is it important, both here and in Japan? It really goes back, I think, to my colleague's comments, which is the mix of what we do together. I know in the United States, for example, that manufacturing creates 90% of the patents. So if you think about the new economics of growth that has been emerging over the last 20 years, how much of that depends on technology and our ability to lift our productivity. When you look at our manufacturing sector, what you have to recognize is that's the heart and soul of technological development. And that's as true in Japan as it is in the United States. We approach it differently, but together, the combination, as you see in a number of U.S. and Japanese companies, it's extraordinarily powerful. And that is not only a gift to both the United States and Japan, but it's a gift to the global economy in terms of the growth trajectory. I mean, think about China's success. A lot of China's success is taking technologies and the way we organize business from Japan and the United States and applying in China. It's one of the problems why they've got challenges in terms of employment, right? Because the truth is they're taking systems that don't require a lot of employment. They're using them in China. For example, General Motors and Toyota don't dumb down their system when they go to China. They take the best practices to China, in effect. So in one sense, thinking hard about manufacturing in the United States and its prospects and Japan, and thinking about it together, and thinking about the crucible that presents in terms of technology, and why we should then adapt our tax policies, our export promotion policies, sort of across the board to ensure that that thrives in both the United States and Japan, is not only, like I say, a gift that we give our own communities, but it's actually a gift we give the world.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking our panel for their very interesting and provocative comments.